Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. What has become a regular feature of the Intelligent Medicine Podcast is a weekly colloquy in which I endeavor to answer questions, accompanied by Layla Mutin, who's our guest today. She's the Hoffman Center nutritionist. We've worked together in a teamwork fashion in the office, so why not here on the Intelligent Medicine Podcast? Welcome again, Layla. It's nice talking to you once more.
Oh, thanks, Dr. Hoffman. How are you?
Good, thanks. So first question for you today is, and we have questions from our listening audience. The way it works is radioprogram@AOL.com. Pose your question via that email, and we'll endeavor to answer during our podcast. But the first question I have for you today is, what did you have for lunch today?
Oh, I had some leftover...
Warts and all now.
No.
We didn't rehearse this segment.
This is what I had for lunch. I had, on a bed of arugula, I had some cucumber salad with some red onion and a nice bit of apple cider vinegar. I had some leftover sliced steak. It was from a London broil. And I had about a third of an avocado in there. That's what I had for lunch.
That sounds great.
It's delicious.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And so you didn't hit the fast food places for lunch or, order hamburger and fries or something.
I didn't go to McDonald's today, no.
No. Your usual lunch hangout.
Right.
So I'll share what I had, for lunch today. And this is fairly typical. By the way, this is not necessarily exemplary because today I was in a big rush. I saw patients at the Hoffman Center in the morning, and then I came home. And I was kind of starved because I actually got up and I did a morning swim. And I had kind of a minimal breakfast, but I burned up a lot of calories with the morning swim. So I was just starved. It was about 2:30. So I decided to go to, there's a nice little eatery that's right across the street from me. And I ordered, this is a nice dish. It was, there's a little counter there where they prepare custom combos. And the guy, it's a Chinese guy. So you can order a type of protein over a type of either white rice or brown rice or noodles. I selected the brown rice. And you can have chicken or you can have shrimp or you can have beef. And I chose the chicken. So, and then you get like all these vegetables that they fry up right in front of you with,
nice,
they claim, olive oil. I'm not sure if it's extra virgin olive oil, but there's a big sign saying that we use olive oil and we use domestic American ingredients. I guess some people have said, do you use Chinese ingredients? And people got kind of freaked out. So they said they use domestic American ingredients. And it was topped off with hot chili garlic sauce. You get a choice of sauces. So I decided on the medium chili garlic sauce. And it was delicious. I just ate it all. So I feel quite content talking to you. I'm fueled up and ready to go with my cup of decaf sitting in front of me. And since we talked about that on our last podcast, I guess I'm ready to roll with that, and it's okay. It's Swiss water processed decaf. So so we're both fueled up and ready to go. And this has been an interesting week because we had the promulgation of the cholesterol guidelines, new cholesterol guidelines, and the headline is new cholesterol guidelines released. Twice as many Americans may be on statins if these are followed. And so I promptly wrote an article for one of my favorite publications, Mind Body Green, on the subject. I've already had nearly 1,000 tweets and Facebook posts of that article. And so clearly that has set off some interest. And what was of interest today is that there's a lot of controversy about these guidelines because Paul Ridker, you know what Paul Ridker is? He's a professor at Harvard. He's actually the guy who came up with the highly sensitive CRP, C-reactive protein. And so he has weighed in, and it's created a great deal of controversy because there's a headline in the New York Times, which I also posted on Facebook. You know, follow me on Facebook or follow me on Twitter because I try to stay abreast of these controversies. Even the New York Times now says that these new guidelines, which were promulgated just last week, may be exaggerating the number of people who really need to be on statins. So they've been already criticized by Paul Ridker, who's a very prominent cardiologist who believes, and a mainstream cardiologist. He's not like a holistic doctor or anything. He says that these guidelines are so broad that it's going to mean more and more people are unnecessarily put on statins. And then right away, the authors of the guidelines defended themselves. They're already trying to issue a counter punch. There's a big brouhaha going on about this, saying, Dr. Ridker is, he's an alarmist. He shouldn't be talking about this in the press. We should be addressing this in scientific journals and not turning this into a sideshow. It's become quite a brouhaha about these guidelines.
Wow.
But at least it's being discussed. And I think what I'm going to do is talk a little more about it in my next podcast upcoming after mm-hmm. this podcast, the one that we'll post tomorrow.
Terrific.
So,
I was looking forward to it.
Yeah, and from our standpoint, once again, we're undaunted. We're not inalterably opposed to statins, but we endeavor really to try and get patients to utilize all the natural methods at their disposal to reduce their risk of cardiovascular disease.
Absolutely. And there are many risk factors to look at, and you've said over and over that, somebody with a cholesterol of 300 is walking around without any calcification in their arteries, looking at an EBT heart scan. Yet on the other hand, somebody with a cholesterol of maybe 175 has calcification. So what are we really talking about here?
And what
irks me,
is that, you can get a lifetime subscription to statin drugs courtesy of your insurance policy or the Affordable Care Act. Or Medicare, maybe even Medicaid in the future, and yet they won't pay for a simple EBT heart scan. And another scandal, I think, is that, and I posted this article recently, is that one of the big failings of the Affordable Care Act, and I'm not saying that the Affordable Care Act is making things worse, it's just not making things better in this regard, there's a big article that just came out today, and I posted it, about how there is no provision, or virtually no provision, for nutrition counseling for people who have high cholesterol. It's all about, whether or not to put a person on statin and, how many cholesterol blood tests you're going to get. But there's no component for saying, hey, okay, you have risk. Let's refer you to a professional nutritionist like you in a doctor's office, because the doctors, either they're poorly trained or they don't have time or they don't want to bother. They can't be doing this on an individual basis. They need nutritionists in their office, and that should be reimbursed.
Yes, absolutely, it should be reimbursed. And right now, I believe nutritionists are only being reimbursed for medical nutrition therapy for renal disease, and not enough really for anything else. And that renal disease being associated with diabetes, we're trying to get more diabetes and pre-diabetes metabolic syndrome on this too. It all does need to start with nutrition. I believe that nutrition has to be absolutely mandatory with a visit to a primary care physician at the very least.
Yeah, here's the article. I posted it on Facebook, so friend me on Facebook or follow me on Facebook. The article is from sciencedaily.com. And the headline is New Heart Disease and Stroke Prevention Guidelines, the ones that I've been talking about, are not fully supported by health insurance. And here's a quote from the article. This is just a killer. I just think this is scandalous. The quote is, "For millions of Americans, health insurance fails to provide sufficient coverage for the nutrition services recommended by the new guidelines." So they're saying, if you're at risk, improve your nutrition. Well, how are you going to improve your nutrition? Your doctor's going to say what? Eat better? Don't eat too much fat, or toss out some casual recommendation that's probably wrong anyway.
Exactly. Thank you for saying that, Dr. Hoffman, because many mainstream doctors...
Don't eat any fat, don't eat any cholesterol, something
like
that.
Yeah. Many doctors are not qualified nutritionists. I'm sorry. It's true. They're still giving dinosaur guidelines. The heart... prudent diet in hospitals is still a low-fat, high-carb mess. This is terrible. They're not qualified. They do need to refer to qualified nutritionists. Absolutely.
And that's precisely what this article says, and I'm quoting again, "Without coverage, physicians are unlikely to refer patients to registered dietitian nutritionists who have the time and training to effectively provide nutrition therapy and facilitate behavior change." So, we've got clearly a boon for the pharmaceutical industry for the quick fix of prescribing cholesterol drugs, but no funds, no attention, no allocation for a truly meaningful intervention, which would be a diet modification, perhaps the use of certain nutraceuticals, although, you know, some people won't be using them, some doctors don't believe in them, but at the very least, the right kind of lifestyle modification that could turn this epidemic around.
Absolutely. And, you know, all those doctors that will be putting their patients on, say, a Lipitor or something like that, they're not going to also tell them, hey, you need some CoQ10 too.
Right.
So, they're not going to know that, and that's a detriment as well. So, you know. Oh, boy. Nutrition has to become the mainstream,
yeah.
You know, as you've been doing for so many years.
Indeed. So, I mean, look, it's frustrating, but nonetheless, you know, it's a teachable moment. We're airing the issue. And I think, you know, judging by the reaction to my article at mindbody.com and on Facebook and on Twitter, this message is really resonating among people. People are not just saying, oh, yeah, here's the new guidelines, you know, we're all going to go on statin. A lot of people just very upset that this is the direction that the heart disease establishment is taking.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Which actually is a great lead into a question.
Go ahead.
Dr. Hoffman, this is from Kristen. We know Kristen, she comes to our lectures. She says, Dr. Hoffman, knowing that you're going to address the new cholesterol guidelines in your upcoming podcasts, can you share your thoughts on the difference between particle size and LDL oxidation testing?
All right.
Although the EBT seems to be the gold standard for now, I know all of my patients may not be able to afford this exam in order to avoid statins that are not truly indicated. Kristen actually is a nutritionist.
Yes. So, let's talk about that. And first of all, let's address her concern because, you know, she's right that what they're trying to do with these cholesterol guidelines is they're trying to keep it simple and inexpensive. And so as a result, they just look at LDL as one big aggregate. So they say if you have an LDL over 190, you absolutely need to be on a statin, you know, in every instance.
Yeah.
And that may be the case because that's a pretty high LDL. But just as we break down cholesterol into LDL and HDL components, the so-called good cholesterol versus the so-called bad cholesterol, LDL is generally thought to be the bad cholesterol, but within that, if you slice it and dice it, there is very bad LDL and not so bad LDL and pretty benign LDL. So a couple of ways to do that. One is to look at what's called the particle size. And I think some people have heard about these profiles. They're called lipoprotein profiles. They're sometimes referred to as VAPS profiles, lipoprotein fractionation, where you actually look at the size of the LDL particles. And it turns out that if you have large, fluffy LDL, which is pattern A, That's actually a pretty benign pattern. You could have a fairly high LDL and it's not going to harm you. If you have a small, dense LDL particles, those are more damaging somehow to the arterial wall. Maybe it's because they're small. They act as like little bullets that damage the endothelium or the lining of the arteries and set the stage for atherosclerosis and inflammation. So another way, and as you know, because we use both these tests,
mm-hmm.
And we just ordered this on a gentleman who came in earlier. He's actually
That's
a doctor,
right.
And you know, he wanted some more guidance on whether he should be concerned. He's at that age where men are starting to be concerned about cardiovascular risk. He has some young children. He wants to know, you know, should he be concerned about cardiovascular risk? His LDL is a little high. And I said, let's break it down. Let's do the LDL particle size test, and let's also do oxidized LDL because, you know, we talk about antioxidants. Antioxidants are good, and oxidized compounds are more dangerous. So when you take LDL that may not be so healthy to begin with, and you oxidize it, you make it infinitely more dangerous and reactive. And so we actually measure the percentage of the LDL that's oxidized, and we can give a heads up to patients that they're at risk. Now, some of this is genetic, and some of it is acquired. I mean, if you take more antioxidants, especially if you use antioxidant compounds like olive leaf, which has beneficial polyphenols and natural things like resveratrol, you can reduce the oxidation of your LDL and protect it, not just with the alphabet antioxidants like vitamin E, C, A, and zinc, selenium, which are minerals. You can also use the natural antioxidants. So, you know.
The other thing that we see that's related to the oxidation of LDL might be high blood sugars, hemoglobin A1C, causing those AGEs, those advanced glycation end products, which can then oxidize that LDL and, you know, induce it to form plaque in coronary arteries. So it's very useful also to look at blood sugar and insulin levels and hemoglobin A1C as well. Yeah.
And bad fats, you know, like fried fats and the omega-6 fats. They're unstable. They, you know, chemically they have unstable bonds, and they may create free radicals within the bloodstream and damage the LDL particles. So if you're eating at, you know, McDonald's, and you're getting a lot of the wrong kind of... Gee, I forgot to take my phone off the hook. I'll have to pull it out. So that could be part of the problem.
You know, I just read an article the other day, I'm sure you've seen it too, that there needs to be more attention paid to the consumption of all of these vegetable oils that have been touted to be so heart healthy, but they're not. All that corn oil, soybean oil, sunflower oil, safflower oil, cottonseed oil is probably the worst. These are some of the worst vegetable fats that we could have. They're not meant to be consumed this way in nature. And that ratio in our bodies of the omega-3 to omega-6, or rather the other way around, omega-6 to omega-3 should be more like 4-to-1 or 2-to-1. And in the standard American diet, you know, the fried foods and the McDonald's.
It's reversed. It's precisely
reversed. It's reversed. Yes, it's more like 20-to-1, 50-to-1. It's terrible. And this is probably a primary cause of coronary artery disease.
Right. So, you know, in answer to Kristen's question, we should actually have funding for this type of test. I mean, goodness knows, you know, every time a kid falls off a jungle gym, you know, they do an MRI for, you know, whatever, $800 or $1,200 to make sure that they don't have critical brain damage and to fend off lawsuits. These tests, I mean, they're more expensive than ordinary cholesterol tests, but they're not exorbitant. And at some point or another, when we're analyzing people's risk, we should take a look at these things because, I mean, certainly for our patients, they provide a teachable moment, and they're, you know, tests are good to tell you if a person's going to have a problem. They're also good to motivate patients to take corrective action. And certainly for our patients, these tests are valuable. So I'm going to share something with you from this, you know, while we're talking about Kristen. Kristen shared something very nice with me on my Facebook page, and I'm, you know, I don't want to put Kristen on the spot, but this isn't confidential. She put it up publicly on my Facebook page, and she had something very nice to say. She writes, as an integrative RD, she, like you, is a registered dietitian, working in both a conventional and integrative setting. I do not believe in a low-fat, high-carb diet, which has clearly contributed to our diabetes, Alzheimer's epidemics. While we are trained that a low-fat diet, high fiber, and whole grains is the standard protocol, I can only hope that the new generation of dietitians, nutritionists, will open their eyes to the science that clearly supports a diet adequate in healthy fat and low in carbs, not just for heart disease, but for all inflammatory conditions that fail to cease with traditional nutritional protocols. However, the physicians also need to be on board with this approach in treating chronic disease, inflammatory conditions. Otherwise, we're losing the battle. I struggle to find physicians of this mind frame that will refer patients to me in my private practice. In the conventional setting where I'm employed, I can only hope I do not lose my job for allowing one of my 300-pound congestive heart failure patients to have a whole egg at breakfast because he's barely eating. But did have this one request. Imagine if I recommended magnesium to help with blood sugar. I'm overwhelmed with joy that my recommendation to check vitamin D levels are on occasion approved. Nutrition is key, and our government continues to fail to address this in terms of their recommendations. So the dilemma still remains, even when dietitians are covered by insurance, are they really addressing the problems with the conventional protocols, followed by 5 question marks?
Yeah. Kristen, I hear you.
She's frustrated.
Absolutely. And I completely understand that. This reminds me back in my days as a hospital dietitian, and
And nutritionists are frustrated, especially aware nutritionists who are aware of the latest findings. And Kristen, I know, really tries to stay abreast of all the latest developments in nutrition. She follows our podcast. Yeah. She comes to our seminars. She does extensive reading, not just about, you know, stuff that we put out, but you know what some of the top thinkers in this field are talking about. And this is enabling her to be a more independent-minded, progressive nutritionist. And so, you know, we're happy to see that there's a small but dedicated core of nutritionists who just don't want to take the old protocols for granted.
And if I may mention, the dietitians in integrative and functional medicine, that's a dietetic practice group that both she and I, belong to, and we talk all about these via email all day long. There's a newsletter that's pretty much on top of all of this, so hopefully the tide will be turning. The tide is turning. It's slow, but it's turning. It has to.
Great.
It has to.
All right. I have a question on the subject of osteoporosis from Dennis. You have that one, too. You want to read it?
Yeah. Yeah, Dennis says, Dr. Hoffman, I have osteoporosis with a lumbar reading of negative 3.0 and a left hip at negative 2.7.
So my first comment is, Dennis is a guy.
Yeah.
So, guys, heads up. You too can have osteoporosis.
Yeah.
It's just that it tends to occur less frequently and at an older age in men. But man, when an 80-year-old guy breaks a hip, it is disastrous. There's almost a 50% fatality rate for older men who break their hips. And I can understand that because I broke my hip when I was a vigorous athlete and I was young. I was 54 years old. And man, does that drag you down. I mean, if I had been weaker or if I had less will to recover and survive, I think it just could have dragged me under like a deep undertow,
wow.
one of those undertows at the beach.
Wow. Yeah, I remember that. But you got on board, you had your physical therapy and your good nutrition, and there you go. Wow.
30 consecutive intravenous treatments the first month when I had it too. Remember,
wow.
I had, the nurse would work at the Hoffman Center in the daytime and then come over to my apartment and give me my own custom intravenous blend that I think really helped put me on the right track. But anyway,
and then, so Dennis tells us his numbers for osteoporosis, and he says, my endocrinologist recommends Forteo. I am currently taking vitamin D, calcium, magnesium, boron, and MK7, which is vitamin K. My question, wouldn't I be better off adding strontium, which might or might not build bone more slowly? I'm concerned that Forteo is an injectable, has a black box warning on osteosarcoma in rats, and seems to have a lot of side effects, including orthostatic hypotension. At what point, Dr. Hoffman, would you tend to recommend Forteo over strontium?
Okay.
And will doing weight-bearing exercise make a difference? And what do you think of those vibration machines?
Okay, so let's tackle these questions one by one. I don't understand why Forteo is so popular. I mean, I could see it for someone who has profound osteoporosis, all right? And look, just as cholesterol medication has value for some people who are really at high risk, and, I think that a person who's had a heart attack or has just undergone bypass surgery, they're very vulnerable, they may need to be in a statin at least for a while. Or for someone who has already had a pathological fracture or who has profound osteoporosis, maybe Forteo, you really need to go with the big guns. But this is a guy who just crossing the threshold for osteoporosis, because minus 2.7 is just on the side of osteoporosis, and minus 3 is, getting there. But it's not like he's at the end of the line. And we routinely see patients who have these types of reading, and predominantly women, of course, but some men, and they do really well when we add strontium to the regimen. And also, I have to say, I'm very proud to say that nobody who I've given strontium to, and I've given it to, scores of patients now, A, has had any kind of side effects, and B, none of them have had a subsequent fracture. And so it seems to be very helpful at staving off fractures, improving bone density. You've seen the results,
yeah,
Layla. We just
absolutely
saw a patient who had like a 14% improvement in just a year in their,
yes,
bone density.
Yes.
So that's just an improvement that just knocks the socks off some of the drugs. Forteo, I'm a little less concerned about cancer risk in Forteo, although it did cause cancer in rats, but rats aren't people, and they, sometimes if you give,
exactly,
super colossal doses of a certain medication to animals, you will see side effects. I mean, theoretically, it is a concern. But why go there? It's just overkill. The other one that, they're just, some of these newer medications are being used wholesale unnecessarily. And, I've really done, as you know, I've done a 180 in my approach to osteoporosis. The advent of such supplements as vitamin K, higher doses of vitamin D, my own osteo support, Ostera, by the way.
Ostera.
Yeah, which is a concentrated extract of hops, has an anti-inflammatory effect on bone. By the way, just for, you know, I'm mentioning these obscure supplements. Some of you know this, but for those who don't, drhoffman.com is a repository of information about some of these supplements, and also there's a store there. And and we have the highest quality supplements there, and we would be very happy to fulfill your order for supplements. And that's also one of the ways in which you can underwrite these podcasts, which are available to you for free. So patronize the drhoffman.com website. Check out the store. Our supplements are comparably priced to other high-quality supplements across the Internet. And, I think that's the answer. So, go ahead.
What about those? Well, first of all, I'd like to know, and Dennis doesn't say here what age he is, number one. Number two, I'd be very interested in his DHEA sulfate levels.
And his testosterone, because that's a great way to enhance bone density in a man. It's like, you have to ask the question, why are you osteoporotic? Are you osteoporotic because maybe he's taking an acid-blocking medication that's blocking his absorption of magnesium or calcium. These medications are some people are put on them for a lifetime, and they are known to cause osteoporosis. Or maybe he's been on steroids for various types of problems. But typically, men who are osteoporotic, they have low testosterone or DHEA.
And the weight-bearing exercise, definitely, it should make a difference. I'm not sure that it would take him all the way. It's got to be significant weight-bearing exercises. But again, if you don't have the proper nutrients, the nutrition, the body weight, all of that. And Dr. Hoffman, he does, his last question is, and what do you think of the vibration machines?
I think that the vibration, I'm really intrigued by the vibration machines.
I am too.
And I actually have a standing invitation to the manufacturer of one of the lead vibration machines that's been researched, the one that's been researched at Stony Brook. They seem to be a little reluctant to come on the air and talk about it because they're right now in negotiations with the Food and Drug Administration to get authorization to A, sell it, and B, make claims about it. I mean, it's really hard to get a medical device approved in this country because of the stringent requirements for research and documentation. And they've done great research, multi-million-dollar research at Stony Brook on this, using first animals, and then they're beginning to use it on humans. The vibrations occur at kind of a low frequency, so you stand on it for a few minutes a day, and you can talk. I mean, I guess you kind of go, while you're on the thing. But, the vibration sends a signal to your bones that triggers the release of growth factors and prompts the activation of what are called osteoblasts, which are bone-building cells. And there's, you know, a specific frequency, and I figured out, you know, what the frequency is in hertz that does the best job for building bone. And I think it's a really cool idea. The other issue is the price point. I mean, I have most of these things cost, you know, over $1,000. And, so it's not within easy reach as a, you know, consumer item like a bathroom scale or a, you know, or a, a heart monitor. But, you know, there's an emerging science about the vibratory platforms. They're small, it's not a big apparatus. It's probably the size of a, large bathroom scale. And you stand on it for a few minutes every day and it actually sends helpful vibrations to your body.
It's fascinating. You know, this just brings to mind a friend of my mother's. This was back in the 70s. She had this. Do you remember this fat burning machine that also vibrated, Dr. Hoffman? You sit like with a belt around you attached to this machine.
Yeah.
And it kind of vibrates you. I'm not sure how, or the belt kind of goes around the backside.
No,
or
those torso. Those are like from the 1950s. I mean, they used to be in magazines.
Was it the 1950s?
This, right? I mean, the thing that kind of rubbed the rain, I don't know about that. That seems to be a little bogus, you know, something that oscillates your fat. Although the claim is made that there may be some fat burning effect, and there certainly is maybe a muscle strengthening effect. I think some of the NFL teams are using these platforms for exercise to help rehabilitate patients. You know, patients have patients. I'm talking about players. If players have injuries, it seems to help with muscle repair because it's again the same vibratory impulses are promote healing apparently. So you know, there's something to it. I'm going to see if I can scan through my podcasts. You know, maybe if you talk for a few minutes, I'll see if I can come up with the name of that product. And you can sign up for information, but I just don't see. I see there's kind of a logjam about marketing these products because of the FDA. You know, the FDA. God bless them. You know, they're there to protect us, but unfortunately, they fast-tracked a lot of bad drugs. And they prevent us from getting a lot of benign things, you know, like this vibratory platform because of their stringent requirements. And now they want to have purview over our supplements. So, you know.
Yeah, well, you know, 60% of the FDA's board are former, you know, pharmaceutical executives. That's really the big conflict of interest here.
Right.
So they have,
right.
They have an interest in pushing all the drugs forward and not so much other devices, although, you know, there are the share of devices that aren't very good. You keep hearing about that on television, about like the vaginal mesh thing and the certain knee replacement, hip replacement devices that haven't been tested properly. I was even reading something like that in Consumer Reports. It was actually very scary. And it was a doctor who had gotten a hip replacement and had that particular device that was not tested properly.
Yikes.
And he was having problems. That's the ultimate scary story, if you ask me. I mean, this is a doctor.
Yeah.
So that and but overall, I mean, for injury, the rehab, medical devices are very. I've had physical therapy. I've had surgery on both of my feet. I've had electrical stimulation. I've had all kinds of things that were wonderful for bringing on, for enhancing healing. And things like that. So,
yeah, I think there's great potential.
Big fan of physical therapy. Yeah,
I have one that we overlooked. I think from almost a couple of months ago, but I don't know if we ever answered this one. Lorianne writes, Dr. Hoffman, can you talk about what happens to the body after thyroid radiation and how to treat it on Intelligent Medicine, especially the weight gain? I was radiated 111, and since 7/12 have gained 70 pounds. I was a size 10, now a size 18. All right. This is a little complicated because she also has had gastric bypass surgery in 2003. Okay, so she had thyroid radiation. Now, it sounds like she had hyperthyroidism. That's the main reason for thyroid radiation, unless it's for cancer. I suspect it's because her thyroid was overactive. So here's what happens. If you have Graves' disease or hyperthyroidism, your body is on kind of like on speed, and you really have to slow down the thyroid because while it sounds like a good thing metabolically, ultimately you get burned out. And it can damage your heart and cause you to be osteoporotic. It's nasty. So you have to get your thyroid slowed down. So sometimes you do it with medication. Sometimes you do it with surgery. You remove the thyroid. And sometimes you zap your thyroid with radiation, usually by drinking radioactive iodine. I don't know what she did. She just said she had thyroid radiation. She says she's gained 70 pounds. So I clearly, you know, this has something to do with her thyroid slowdown. So, you know, we have patients like that. What do you tell them generally?
Well, if their thyroid's been destroyed by radiation, they're basically walking around without thyroid. They need thyroid replacement therapy, certainly. That would be the first place to start.
So I would suspect, you know, the first thing I would do if she were to become a patient is I would make sure that she's on adequate thyroid replacement because sometimes they just, you know, I call it kicking a field goal. You know, it's like if you kick the ball through the uprights, you know, it's a little to the left or a little to the right within the uprights, you're still 3 points, you know, either way. But if you are a little bit on the low side, the test reads normally, but you're not getting enough thyroid. So we try to move it towards the upper range of normal. People are lethargic, slow, achy. It's possible she's not getting enough thyroid, or maybe she needs natural thyroid. That works better in some people. And then there's a host of
others. Well, she's given the wrong thyroid medication.
Exactly.
We've seen enough people come through here, and they're on the wrong thyroid medication.
She says,
and then you wind up putting them on the right one. And
She says, I feel sick, and my body hurts all over, and I have no energy to exercise. I used to walk 30-plus miles per week. I can barely walk 3 blocks now. So clearly, you know, she's obviously got a metabolic problem because she had gastric bypass surgery. The other thing is, You know, we see a
she
few
could be
patients
anemic from that too. Yeah.
Yes, we see quite a few patients who've had gastric bypass surgery, and they really have. There's a lot of nutritional considerations involved in gastric bypass. You want to discuss some of them?
Well, first of all, I've seen too many that are chronically anemic no matter what we try to do or what they've tried to do on their own before coming to see us. So that's a big one right there. I could think of one patient off the top of my head who goes through cycles several times a year where his ferritin low, he's just so anemic that he really can't get around, and it's quite sad.
Because part of the gastrointestinal system that is designed to absorb certain nutrients has been bypassed. It's like they have a short gut syndrome, and their absorptive surface is less, therefore they get less calories, but they also get less nutrients, so they have special nutrient needs.
Exactly. And, you know, anybody after gastric bypass is basically put on a 500-calorie-a-day diet, because if you ate any more than that, you would throw up.
No, but here's the deal.
This is a terrible way to live.
But here's the deal. She gained 70 pounds. This is after a bypass, gastric bypass.
It's
an unsuccessful bypass.
She stretched the bypass. You know what? We've seen that, too.
Yeah.
They stretched the bypass, and then they regained the weight. So
you still have to follow the right kind of diet. I mean, you can't be guzzling.
The behavior has to change once and for all.
You can't be guzzling milkshakes or something like that, because then you will literally, you will be able to bypass that small stomach and get calories into your system. So, I mean, there's a lot of information missing from her history here that we'd like to know about.
Yeah.
Okay, this next question is about Satan worship.
Oh, yes.
I'm talking not Satan worship, but Satan worship. You know what Satan is? Tell us about Satan.
It's wheat gluten.
Right.
It's the gluten itself.
Right.
That is then cooked and made into mock meat. It's in a lot of vegan products and so forth.
So here's the question. Do you think, this is from Lisa, do you think Satan is a good thing to eat for a vegetarian looking for low-carb, high-quality protein? And my answer, this is on Facebook, I wrote, if you want to eat pure wheat gluten, and Lisa writes back, well, if a person doesn't have celiac, is that still bad? I had read somewhere, since that amount of gluten is not normal, it is probably not a good thing to eat and could potentially create a gluten intolerance. I know you have a low-carb vegetarian menu on your website. Is there some way I could get that? I guess we can get to that. Do we have a low-carb vegetarian menu on our website?
No, not on our website. No.
Okay, maybe that's a good idea to see if we can.
Yeah.
It's a little hard to achieve. You know, when you're total vegan, that's one of the disadvantages of total veganism. It's a little hard to achieve a truly low-carb diet. But anyway, so I said, let's take up your questions on the next podcast. Good night. And she writes, thank you. So this is like a little late night exchange. So, well, let's talk a little bit about Satan worship. I have actually direct experience with this because I was once macrobiotic. About when I was first getting into medical practice, I was advocating a vegan macrobiotic diet, and I followed that diet myself for many years. And seitan was one of the ways in which I got protein, you know, other than tofu and beans. This was a way in which I introduced protein into my diet. Of course, there were nuts, but there was no fish, there was no dairy, there was, of course, no chicken, meat, none of that. And so, at first, seitan was not something you could buy. I had to make the stuff at home. And what a mess that was. I remember one time I was at home making it alone, nobody else was there. And I literally almost had to call 911 because it was good that my wife was about to return from shopping or going out, because she literally came into the apartment and rescued me from a vat of seitan. My hands were all stuck inside of it. It was so glutinous, and it should have been if they had a YouTube videos, it would have been great. What you do is you take flour and you smush it around in water, and the starch comes off as sort of a milky white thing, and you rinse it. You keep rinsing and rinsing and rinsing it. Finally, what's left is the gluten, and it's very sticky and glutinous, as you might imagine.
Mm-hmm.
And then you marinate it with some soy sauce, and I'm not sure if you even cook it. I guess you probably cook it. I don't remember how. And then pretty soon it was made available in health food stores, and I said, man, that's the last time I'm going to make this stuff at home because that's a big mess. And so it's considered a meat substitute by vegetarians.
Yes.
So I did a little research on this, and 1 ounce of seitan actually has a considerable amount of protein. There's 21 grams of protein, and there's only 4 grams of carbohydrates. So that's a pretty favorable ratio of protein to carbohydrates. The problem is that there's probably a certain amount of protein in tree bark. It's just not that bioavailable. You know, it's if you're a termite, you might be
That's
able to get it.
That's true, too.
You know, so what the problem is that a lot of the protein in seitan is in the form of something called prolamine. And one of the prolamines is gliadin. And gliadin is, actually, we measure antibodies to gliadin. Unfortunately, we find frequently we find patients have antibodies to gliadin. That means their immune system is reacting adversely because of it. So in addition to the possibility of celiac disease, there's a possibility of intolerance. There's also the protein that is there that's 21 grams. That's a considerable amount. But is it really as bioavailable as if you have, say, some hamburger or a piece of chicken or a piece of salmon or
right.
some egg, you know, cooked egg?
Right.
It's much more bioavailable.
Yeah, because gliadin is that 33 amino acid protein, or gluten is a 33 amino acid protein that many humans, or can we say most humans, I'm quoting Peter Green's book now.
Yes.
We don't have the enzymes to digest that properly.
Yes.
And I could just imagine if you take gluten and you make it even more potent by isolating it like that, wow, that could do a number on somebody's intestines
yes.
eventually.
Yes.
Unless you have no gluten sensitivity at all, you could probably go eat it. But, yeah.
Yeah.
That's a big question mark.
So, you know, I got to say that, you know, it's different strokes for different folks. It works for some people. The other thing is that the, you know, they talk about the complementarity of amino acids. And starting with an egg is a perfect protein. It's got all the amino acids that are necessary for growth because it's actually there to nourish the embryo. And wheat has a rather unbalanced amino acid composition. It's very low in lysine, for example, the critical amino acid. It's high in other things, but it's missing certain ones. That's why in traditional cultures, you know, in Mexico, for example, you'll have rice and beans or wheat tortilla and beans, because even, you know, to get a complete protein, you have to mix the different different foods together to get a complete protein spectrum.
The lysine, the methionine, yes.
Yes, yeah. So, and, you know,
but you put rice and beans together, it's hard to go low carb. That right there is a high carb
exactly.
meal.
Exactly. And that's the other point. And, there's also some concern that, you know, small amounts of gluten can be tolerated, but if you overload the system with gluten, particularly early in life, you may induce a gluten intolerance later. So,
you know, even later in life, and, you know, you and I have both seen this. We see people, and it's almost like a threshold thing. The more bread the person is eating, those antibodies over time, they can go up.
Yeah.
They can go up, and then we see a gluten sensitivity established. So it's really fast. It's remarkable, really, what we're seeing. But it's also the wheat plant, the wheat crop in this country also has a lot more gluten, or is hybridized to have a lot more gluten than anywhere else in the world.
Yes.
Pretty much. So there's that problem.
You know, what's interesting is that all this concern about gluten and a low-carb diet, recently there was an article that I saw that suggests that, what's the name of the wheat belly guy, that doctor who writes about the wheat belly?
William Davis.
William Davis. And together, he and Dr. David Perlmutter may be single-handedly responsible for a drop in consumption of wheat in the United States by about 22%.
Wow.
So wow. If I were one of those guys, I would hire some bodyguards because the wheat board is very powerful, and they might put a hit on them.
No, wow, okay.
Yeah, I'm a big voice in this community, but not at that level. I think I can have a lower profile, so I'll be okay. I mean, if I
we'll
hear
keep
footsteps,
the bodyguards on hold for
if
you.
If I hear footsteps behind me in a dark alley, I'll know who it's from. Well, it could be, you know, the folks from the American Heart Association or the manufacturers of statin drugs. I mean, there's a lot of people who might like to see me take a powder. All right. I have some actually very good news to share. I should have shared this at the top of the podcast, but I'll do this as today's dessert. Our podcast is really taking off. It has been, the podcast was launched over the summer as an ancillary experience for those who are fans of Health Talk, my regular weekly radio program. And so the statistics, this actually, you saw this email, but I'll read it to our listeners.
Yeah,
this is from my producer, Alan. He says, we have a hit on our hands. Here is a list of the podcast downloads by month since we first started in June. The growth is beyond impressive. So in June, we had 16,000 podcasts for the entire month. By July, it had gone up to 25,000. In August, it went up to 34,000. In September, it went up to 44,000. In October, continuing spectacular growth, it went up to 65,000.
Oh, my goodness.
So, you know, I can only conclude that people are finding it valuable, that they're spreading the word, that they're sharing, and we want to encourage them to do so because we want to just hit it out of the park with these podcasts to make it a worthwhile activity. It's good to know that you're listening. But my goal, I want to make it a quarter million. It may not happen, you know, next month.
It'll happen.
But 2014 is not far away, and I want to see 250,000 podcasts in 2014, a quarter million individual listenings to these podcasts. And, you know, so spread the word, share, make people aware of these valuable podcasts because lots of useful information gets shared, and it's, you know, a useful resource beyond what we're able to share on the regular weekend radio broadcast on WOR.
Right, right, right. And yes, thank you for listening, everyone. And you know, the wonderful thing about a podcast is you get to choose. You're not beholden to a particular time or something where you can turn on, you know, say a radio or something like that. So it's convenient.
It's just like the way I watch Homeland. You know, I cannot be fixed in one place, you know, and govern my entire life to be plunked down in front of the TV set at the time precisely when it goes off on Sunday night. So I save up, you know, I may go a couple of weeks without watching, and then I'll have like, I'll just have like a orgy.
A Homeland binge.
Homeland binge. and I'll just catch up on two or three episodes at my discretion when I am relaxed. So you can do that too with Intelligent Medicine Podcast. So thanks for listening. Thanks for sending our numbers through the roof. We appreciate it very much, but know that you're not alone as a health connoisseur and listening to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. Layla, thank you very much. You're also an important ingredient in our success, and we'll keep our weekly discussions. We'll join you again next week. Keep garnering questions. Radioprogram@AOL.com is the way that you can pose your question. Thanks for joining us, Layla.
Thank you.
I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.